smart energy policy or environmental hazard? This morning, a closer look at the discussion around offshore drilling off the Atlantic coast. Good Tuesday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, don't miss it, we'll have a closer look at plans to increase offshore drilling beginning in 2017 along the Eastern Seaboard. You can get on the line now with your questions at 549-2937. Then later, lots of responses streaming in to our First Coast Connect Book Club. We'll also have a preview of the piano lesson at Stage Aurora later in the hour. All of that ahead. But first this morning, offshore drilling. Seismic air gun testing by the oil industry has received approval by the Obama administration, and it should commence this year in the Atlantic Ocean, followed by potential drilling off the East Coast in 2017. Recently, Fernandina Beach and St. Augustine joined with 25 other Eastern Seaboard towns that have passed resolutions opposing this testing. Marine scientists and environmental groups say they oppose drilling off the coast, arguing the process hasn't gotten safer since the BP disaster in the Gulf. However, advocates point out that the billions of barrels of oil waiting beneath the waves is a necessary part of the nation's energy portfolio. Meanwhile, Florida energy advocacy groups gathered in Jacksonville recently to discuss the absence of Florida from a proposed federal plan to conduct offshore oil and gas natural gas exploration starting in 2017. Lots to discuss here, so this morning we're beginning the hour with a closer look. Here in studio, we welcome marine journalist Robert Barringer. Good morning.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And joining us by phone, Eric Melito. He's director of upstream operations at the American Petroleum Institute. Eric, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And we're already getting your calls right now. Let us know your thoughts and questions about the potential for offshore drilling in the Atlantic Ocean. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect, email and tweet the show, or you can give your thoughts on Facebook. Let's begin with you, Robert. You recently noted in a published piece that the small towns of Fernandina Beach and St. Augustine in our listening area joined dozens of other communities up and down the Eastern Seaboard opposing the seismic air gun testing in the Atlantic. Why did they join that list of cities?
Because it's a horrible idea. What's going to happen later this year is that the ships are going to tow what are called seismic cannings. They're going to do a seismic map of the Atlantic Ocean, and these cannons emit a blast of air every 10 seconds, and it to anything in the water, it sounds louder than an airline taking off. And so it disrupts and disorients the mammals and the fish, and there are several instances of them washing up on the shores and beachings of whales and dolphins.
And so environmental groups, Eric, are opposed to, not, of course, not just the testing, but also the drilling. Can you tell us a little bit about the American Petroleum Institute's position in terms of being in favor of this? This 30-year moratorium on drilling off the Atlantic coast is set to expire in 2017.
Yeah, we're strongly in favor, and it's not the industry, it's the public by large amounts favors offshore energy development, particularly in Florida, where we see in the recent Harris poll, 64% of Floridians in support, whereas 28% are in opposition, so almost two-thirds in favor in the state of Florida. But the U.S. is now an energy superpower, a global energy superpower. We're now the largest producer of natural gas, and we're expected to be the largest producer of crude oil. And this has had significant economic benefits for the country, both in the creation of jobs, but also by helping to create better national security by taking power away from countries like Russia and Iran and Venezuela, who use energy in a bad way. So our production has helped us in that way. And offshore energy development is something that should continue us down that positive path.
And let us know your thoughts as we discuss plans to potentially drill for oil beginning in 2017 off Florida's coast. 549-2937. Robert, what about those arguments that we need the oil and that it's good for our national security and creates jobs?
True. There's oil out there in the Atlantic, but we have four oceans surrounding our nation, and three have been drilled extensively for gas and oil. Unfortunately, three have had catastrophic oil spills that have devastated the marine life out there as well. You may recall the 1969 Santa Barbara oil spill, and that introduced Americans to oil-covered beaches and dying birds. And then in the Arctic, you may recall the Exxon Valdez that ran aground and spilling almost a million barrels of oil over 1,300 miles of pristine shoreline. And then everyone remembers in the Gulf of Mexico the 2010 Deepwater Horizon spill that killed 11 and dumped 3.2 million barrels into the Gulf. And the worst part about this is many people don't know that since then, there have been 11 major spills in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's according to the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement. I just don't think the oil industry has clearly demonstrated that they don't have the systems in place to guarantee the public that this won't happen again.
And Eric, what about that? The BP disaster devastated economies all across the Gulf area, across several states. What about those concerns?
Well, the government and the industry take this very seriously. We have a commitment to safety and environmental protection. And if you look at the recent conclusions by the chairs of the BP Gulf Oil Spill Commission, Senator Bob Graham and William Riley, they've said that they are pleased with the way the industry and the executive branch have moved ahead on the commission's recommendations to improve the safety of offshore. And they said offshore drilling is safer than it was 4 years ago, and that's because we have a Center for Offshore Safety in place. We have significantly ramped up regulations to prevent an accident. We now have companies in place that are on hand to provide capping stacks in the event we would have a spill event. So we are in a much better position today. And the other thing we have to recognize is that drilling is going on right now offshore Cuba. The Bahamas are moving forward with developing resources. Canada is. The U.S. is in the best position to do this rather than sitting around watching the rest of the world develop these resources when we can be enhancing our own national security and taking, like I said, that power away from countries like Russia. And drilling does help. We've seen that the price at the pump drop significantly, and a lot of that is because developing additional resources here in the United States.
And if you're just tuning in right now, we're looking at the potential for offshore drilling off Florida's coast beginning in 2017. Advocates say it will add to our energy mix, increase national security, create jobs. Opponents say it would be devastating for marine life and the environment. They're worried about another major spill. We want to know, where do you stand when it comes to offshore drilling? Are you for it or against it? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. Now, Robert, let me ask you as a follow-up. Of course, in Florida, people want to know if this is happening. There's been some discussion about Florida actually not being part of the major plans for seismic testing and drilling. Florida Energy Advocacy Groups, as the Jacksonville Business Journal reported, recently gathered here in Jacksonville, and they were complaining about the absence of Florida from this plan to do the gas and oil exploration. What about that? Are you seeing that Florida could potentially be carved out of this?
Well, I'm hoping that they are, because what can happen is there's no state boundaries for what goes out on the ocean. The original plan was for seismic testing to go from an area of Delaware to roughly Titusville. But even if they don't, if they were to pull back to, say, Georgia, you could still have major devastation, disruption to the fishing industry, and mammals washing up on the beaches here.
And what about that, Eric? Is Florida part of the industry's plans?
Florida is not part of the government's plans. The government has carved out a lot of the Atlantic. It's looking to have development in what is determined to be the mid and south Atlantic, but they are cutting it off at Georgia and Florida boundary. In addition, they're cutting it off north of Maryland. So we're disappointed that so much has been taken off the table. And the initial lease sale would not take place in the Atlantic until 2021. That's more than two administrations away. So the energy that we have in this country to fuel our cars and to heat our homes is because we made decisions 10, 15 years ago to develop resources in places like the Gulf of Mexico. These are long-term investments that can begin creating jobs very soon. But the government has already limited our ability to develop these resources by only having one opportunity, and that's, like I said, not until 2021. So it is a very limited opportunity. We need to make sure we maintain it so that we can grasp these benefits.
And why has the government made Florida something of a no-go zone? And you said north of, I think you said north of Maryland as well.
Well, that's largely based on politics. We've seen states like Virginia, as well as North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, coming out heavily in support from the congressional delegation. So Democratic Senators Mark Warner and Tim Kaine and Governor McAuliffe in Virginia have been highly supportive of it. They've introduced bills in Congress, as well as Republican senators and congressmen in all the states of Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina and Georgia. They've been looking at this and pushing this forward in a real way. So what we need in Florida is for our elected officials at that federal level to step up in the same way to make it happen there as well.
So it sounds as though you're saying our senators Marco Rubio and Bill Nelson haven't come out in favor of this up on the Hill.
They haven't made it as big of an issue as we've seen in some of the other coastal states.
All righty, and let's go to your calls right now. Where do you stand on the issue of offshore drilling? 549-2937. Raymond in Tallahassee. Hey, Raymond, thanks for calling in from Tallahassee.
Good morning. I had a question for Robert. I was wondering if Robert worked for OPEC and why he doesn't talk about the problems that windmills present when they kill birds and what the problems and challenges associated with solar type of things when they have fires in buildings and firemen don't want to go on the roofs there. Doesn't everything have its challenges, Robert? And hidden the oil and gas industry tried really, really hard to progress and move forward from challenges that they faced.
Okay, and that's Raymond. Robert.
Hi, Raymond. Thanks for calling. I'm a marine journalist and licensed sailor. I represent no special interest or political group. But I know about the wind turbines out there. They're developing them in Massachusetts, and they've used them in the North Sea and Europe. And to my knowledge, they've been very successful there. What I can tell you for sure is that Healthy Atlantic supports 1.4 million jobs and about $95 billion in gross domestic product that would be jeopardized by drilling in the Atlantic.
Let's go to Rick at the beaches. Hey, Rick, good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Thank you. I guess two questions. One that really alarms me now is when your guest who's representing the oil industry saying, we'll make the changes when the political people, not what the will of the people of the state of Florida want. So they're working probably with their PAC to get somebody in who's going to support them. It will, and my feeling is, if we start doing this, it's our industry, fishing industry, and all of our people come down to Florida to enjoy vacations are going to be disrupted by this industry. Also, how many of these companies that are going to be involved in this are American-owned and all this money is going to be into America? Or is it going to be like BP again, who's going to come in and say, we got things right, like they did before, and we end up a big oil spill again?
All righty. Thanks for the call, Rick. Eric.
Yeah, what's interesting is the way this has been drafted, excuse me, this initial draft plan, nothing's final yet, is that there's a 50-mile buffer zone that where you could not have oil and gas opportunity. And it's interesting because some states actually allow in their state waters, which run out to 3 miles, to have oil and gas development in their state waters. Well, the federal government itself doesn't allow it. That's in a place like Alaska, where Alaska allows it within 3 miles because they're Alaska waters, but the federal government hasn't been moving forward with it. But the other thing to recognize is that the Gulf of Mexico, even over the past 5 years, the oil and gas industry has worked very compatibly with the fishing industry. The commercial fishing industry in the Gulf is a $980 million per year industry and employs 120,000 people. The Gulf of Mexico is some of the greatest commercial and recreational fishing in the world, and we've seen that experience that would be carried through in the Atlantic as well. And in addition, like I said, most of these prospects that we see, not only the prospects, but we have the buffer zone are several miles out. And as we heard an earlier caller mention, the windmills are actually within 20 miles. So windmills are something you would see under the way the government is planning things from the viewshed point of view, but the oil industry would be further out. And a lot of the work is also done on the seabed, so you couldn't see it from the sight line.
What about that, Robert? If people can't see the drilling apparatus out there in the ocean, What about that?
It's definitely out there. The 50-mile buffer zone will mean absolutely nothing if there's an oil spill. The Deepwater Horizon rig was 42 miles off the mouth of the Mississippi River, and you see what that did to the shores. It fouled over 1,100 miles worth.
Dave on the south side. Go ahead, Dave. What are your thoughts?
I'd like to just make a comment about the disinformation campaign that's being expressed by the oil supply side guys, and that they ignore the fact that OPEC dominates the global oil markets and will for another 15 to 20 years, if not more. And when they make the statement that producing more oil from public lands in the United States will somehow improve our energy security, they're flat out lying. You know, anybody that knows anything about macroeconomics and global supply side oligopies would understand that increasing the U.S. production of oil by just 2 or 3 million barrels a day is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. We consume over 20 million barrels of oil per day, but we only produce 8 to 12 million barrels. That's a deficit of 8 million barrels a day that nobody can make up. The only way to break the oil oligopoly, the OPEC oligopoly, is to reduce our consumption of oil. You have to break the supply side control and our total dependency on oil as a transportation fuel and move to non-petroleum alternatives. And Jacksonville is at the cutting edge of the natural gas and electric vehicle movement that will do that. And the industry needs to start putting more focus, more investment, more capital in long-term plans to break the oil oligopoly and to move our energy systems to non-petroleum sources so we can address the environmental problems, solve the environmental problems, solve the greenhouse gas problem, and move us to a much more sustainable and much more secure energy system that will give us a free hand in terms of our foreign relations in oil-producing countries, where we can do the right things for democracy, to promote democracy and freedom rather than protecting supply-side oligarchs.
That's Dave on the south side. Eric, what about that argument that we should be weaning ourselves off oil as an energy source for all of the reasons he stated?
No, you made some good points here, because it's actually happening. From a demand side, the U.S. is flattening out in the amount of oil that it uses. But globally, and even in the U.S., we're going to continue to rely on oil and natural gas decades to come. And the oil and gas industry is one of the leading investors when you look at zero carbon and low carbon emitting technologies. They're some of the largest investors in geothermal, solar, and wind. But we've had a huge impact on the global market. We've introduced an additional 4 million barrels a day, which has been huge because the price has gone down significantly. And the reaction from the OPEC countries has been to increase their production because they're trying to compete for that same market share that we're trying to get here in the United States. And what that has done is it's put a lot of countries under a lot of economic pressure, because Russia relies upon oil for more than 50% of its economy and 70% of its exports, and they rely on oil being at $100 a barrel, not 50 that it's at right now. So we're having a huge consequence through U.S. Energy development. And our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin M. Dempsey, said this before Congress. He said our energy production can and is having a huge impact on the global stage, and we need to keep an eye on that as something that we can use to help diminish the power exerted by countries like Russia.
Robert, we'll give you the last word since we're almost out of time. Your final thoughts.
Well, for all the risks of drilling in the Atlantic Ocean, they estimate that there's 3.3 billion barrels out there. So that may sound like a lot, but as a nation, that's about 165-day supply of oil. I just don't think it's worth it. It's a beautiful resource that we have here in Jacksonville and up and down the coast. It's healthy and doing great now. We don't need oil. Leave our Atlantic alone.
Well, it's a fascinating topic and two great guests this morning. Thank you both so much for sharing your thoughts. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
We were joined by phone as we welcomed Eric Melito, Director of Upstream Operations at the American Petroleum Institute, and in studio, Jacksonville Marine journalist Robert Barringer, looking at the topic of offshore drilling in the Atlantic. Much more still ahead later, a preview of August Wilson's The Piano Lesson at Stage Aurora. But up next, The Sense of an Ending. It's today's First Coast Connect book club discussion. You can join us right after this.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. The bidding begins March 10th and continues through March 16th. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Alice Fuja,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Time now for this month's edition of the First Coast Connect Book Club. We got a lot of responses as we asked for your participation in our club as we discuss a great book, The Sense of an Ending by British author Julian Barnes. The story is narrated by a retired man named Tony Webster. He recalls how he and his clique of school friends met another boy at school named Adrian Finn and vowed to remain friends for life. When the past catches up with Tony, he reflects on the paths he and his friends took over the years. This story deals with themes of memory and time. Book club blogger Stacy Goldring is here now, and lots of emails came in. I'm so excited.
I know. I'm really glad, too. We got a lot of response, and hopefully it'll be a very interesting discussion. And I think I want to start off with a quote.
Okay.
Very quick quote from the book. What you end up remembering isn't always the same as what you have witnessed.
And why is that? Because the whole idea behind this book is that we edit our memories. We think we remember something exactly the way it happened, but so often it turns out we didn't. Our memory is selective.
Very selective.
And there's a wealth of scientific data to support that.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot out there. But also, some people, I got a very interesting response from someone who talked about that, Naomi. And she told me that it's a defense mechanism. She said, I firmly believe that memories are always invented. The purpose of that mechanism in our brains is to turn actual events into constructed versions of them, is really to help us forget what we cannot bear. Okay, that goes for terrible pain as well as joy. We can neither prolong triumph nor shorten despair. Memory keeps us moving either towards an ideal or away from a fear.
Mm.
You know, so it's something we use to cope with.
Right. And our memories, as we get old, our memory, as the song goes, they're all that's left us when we get really old.
Yeah.
So I think this book is fascinating for so many people because as we get older, our memories become so precious to us.
They do. And not only that, sometimes, as what happens with the main character in this book, Tony Webster, he feels he pretty much has it figured out. He's lived a rather normal life. You know, he had a nice marriage. Amicable divorce. He gets along well with his daughter, okay with his grandchild, and he feels, you know, I'm plugging along. I'm peaceable. He says, I'm a peaceable man. Then he gets a letter in the mail from a lawyer. and it turns his life upside down. And what he has to do is reevaluate his memory of events and compare that to the truth of what happened. And it talks about blame. The words that you've said, you know, we're two very nice people. We're thinking, you know, we haven't left a lot of, there's not a lot of drama we've left in our life. There are no victims laying in our wake as we walked in here this morning, we can hope.
We think so, yes.
We think so.
We hope so.
And even if they're, regardless, we hope that whatever it is, we've rationalized that, we've worked it out, we've painted our best picture.
Uh-huh.
But Tony finds out that someone has committed suicide.
Because of something he did.
Or not.
Or not.
And he has to go back and revisit that. And, you know, it's very tricky. Memory is very tricky. And when you look back, you have to consider the idea of remorse. Do you have remorse for things that you've done? Can you rationalize? Is there a statute of limitations on blame? At some point, do you have to walk away? There is a character in the book. Her name is Veronica. And she says to Tony, in their very old girlfriend, she says, you know what, you just don't get it. And Tony, 65-plus-year-old guy, is saying, I don't know what I don't get. I don't know what I don't get. I don't understand what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
And she says, you just don't get it. And she won't give him any more. And you, as the reader reading Sense of an Ending, you only get to get it through Tony's eyes.
As he becomes more self-aware.
Correct.
You, and the reader, do too.
Right, but do we trust him? Is he even convincing him? Is he painting his own picture in his own mind? And we only get to hear it through his, how he's interpreting what he does and does not get.
Well, we got a lot of emails. So let me get a few on the air. It's our own book club right here on the air this morning. As Lisa emailed the show, I want to say how much I enjoyed the story and how thrilled I am WJCT has these great book discussions with Stacy. I loved this book because now that I'm of a certain age, I was deeply moved by the author's insight concerning memory and nostalgia. The plot kept me interested, but I was frustrated by Tony's egomania and self-importance. He couldn't wrap his mind around the idea that other people had issues that had nothing to do with him. He blamed himself for all of the tragedy when in reality he was just a blip on the radar of the lives of Adrian, Veronica, and her family. I was shocked by the ending and had to go back to the beginning to understand the Greek tragedy that played out throughout the story, unbeknownst to Tony.
Tony, you don't know whether to smack him or feel sorry for him. And this book has one of these endings where you close the book and you go, what? What just happened? Did I just read that right?
And you're almost angry.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you go back and read it and you think, oh my gosh, I can't believe. Is that right? I discussed this in a lot of my book groups, and there were some people who came to the book group and didn't realize what happened. It's so subtle. The writing is so beautiful and so economical.
Those are the best books, though, the ones that have a surprise. And then when you read them the second time, you pick up on all the subtleties you missed the first time.
Right. And I've read it 3 times now. And each time, I am more and more appalled by what happened, because we only bring to the book what we know. We bring our own luggage, we open it up, and we try to understand the story. And that's what Sense of an Ending is about. Once you have another bit of information about something that happens in your life, now you've got to retool. And that's tricky, because now you may have to use a harsher, measure yourself with a harsher brush. What else? What else have people written?
All right. Here's one from Elizabeth. I listen to your show in Australia through online, and I love it. Thanks, Elizabeth. We have listeners all over the world. How about that? This book was a conundrum. I had to read it again after I got to the end, as everything had changed. Do you think that was alluded to in the talk between Mrs. Ford and Tony? I'd like to know what you think.
Well, you know, it depends on what you... The first time I read this interchange that Elizabeth is talking about, and I actually penned it in here somewhere, I didn't read anything into it. The next time I read it, I almost... I guffawed. I couldn't believe what I was reading. So it depends on what you bring to it. Do we have time to read a little bit?
Sure.
Let me go ahead and read what's happening. This is the mother of the girlfriend, and the young man, Tony, has come to visit for the weekend. When I came down for breakfast, only Mrs. Ford was around. The others had gone for a walk, Veronica having assured everyone that I would want to sleep in. I can't have disguised my reaction to this very well, and I could sense Mrs. Ford examining me while she made bacon and eggs, frying things with a slapdash way, breaking one of the yolks. I wasn't experienced at talking at girlfriend's mother's. "Have you lived here long?" I eventually asked, though I already knew the answer. She poured herself a cup, broke another egg. See the egg?
On the cover.
Yeah. Broke an egg, leant against the dresser, and said, "Don't let Veronica get away with too much." I didn't know how to reply. Should I be offended at this inference in our relationship or fall into confessional mode and discuss Veronica? So I said a little primly, "What do you mean, Mrs. Ford?" She looked at me, smiled in an unpatronizing way, shook her head slightly, and said, "We've lived here for 10 years. So in the end, I was almost as much at sea with her as I was with the rest of them, though at least she appeared to like me. She eased another egg onto the plate, despite my not asking for it or wanting it. The remnants of the broken one were still in the pan. She flipped them casually into the swing bin, then half threw the hot frying pan into the wet sink. Water fizzed. Steam rose up the impact, and she laughed as if she had enjoyed causing this small havoc. Well, let me tell you, the first time I read this, I just read it. I'm like, okay, there's an egg thing. I don't get it. Maybe
and the egg is on the cover of the book.
And what do eggs represent?
Yeah.
What do eggs represent?
Life.
Life.
Sure.
And she's cracking them, and she's throwing them in the waste bin, and they're breaking. And then you read this the second go around, or once you have more information in further, and you can really read into this. First of all, who says that? You're a mother of daughters. Would you say that to a boy? Would you say that? Don't let Veronica get away with too much?
Yeah.
I think that's appalling. But what do I know?
Courtney from Brisbane, Australia, emailed the show. We have two emails from Australia this morning. She says, "I really enjoyed the book. I was wondering, does Tony looking back feel remorse about the letter he sent to Adrian, or does he try to convince himself that he feels bad? Does he feel he's to blame?"
Remorse. Remorse is very interesting, isn't it? Because the author uses a great verb with the word remorse. He uses the word curdled. Don't you love that? That's brilliant writing. Mm-hmm. He says, "It wasn't shame. I knew now it was guilt, but more than that, something rarer and stronger, remorse, a feeling which is more complicated, curdled, and primeval."
Mm.
You know, you can talk yourself out of remorse. I'm not convinced that Tony feels remorse for the words that he used that sent someone's life unraveling. But it depends if people choose to read the book and they want to discuss remorse further. You know, it's an interesting topic, but also an interesting title. This is not the first Sense of an Ending.
Oh, really?
There was a Sense of an Ending written in 1967 by a literary critic named Frank Kermond, evidently big British literary critic. This was a nonfiction book about fiction and why we need fiction as humans.
Hmm.
And what he basically says that I will sum up in a few fiction for dummies is we are born and we die and all this stuff happens in the middle.
Uh-huh.
And we need to make sense of this. We need to make sense of this. So we create fiction. We create a story that explains how we get from life to death in order for it to make sense. Otherwise, we freak out. But what happens is our story goes along and then life happens and it throws us a curve. And that's called, and I'm going to really ruin this word, peripeteia. This is a literary term meaning all of a sudden, like in this book, a suicide occurs. Now you have to explain it. So whatever you know about this suicide, you tell a narrative so it makes sense. You get to the end of this book and you're thrown another piece of this peripeteia. And your mind goes like this. And you've got to go and do it all again. You have to look at it again. But what he is saying, Frank Kermond, in Sense of an Ending, is that without having these patterns and making sense, without fiction in our life and these patterns, we'd go nuts.
Yeah.
We all need stories, don't we?
We do.
Which is why this book club is so special, and I can't think of a better person than you to be the leader of
it. Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate your support, and I love talking about literature with you and your listeners. It's really a gift.
It's our first Coast Connect book club. This month's topic was The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. Have you decided on next month's book for us yet?
Well, I am reading a book called All the Light We Cannot See. And this is by Anthony Doerr, D-O-E-R-R. I call this an it book. It is so hot right now. I just had to run a copy of mine over to a friend of mine because she's 364 on the list of the library. So embarrassing. But I'm thinking that maybe, you know, if your listeners want to discuss that book, perhaps they could email you or get in touch with you. And
email us about the book club, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. We love your feedback and suggestions, and maybe that's next month. We'll see.
Great.
Stacey Goldring, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Melissa.
And we're back in a moment.
WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit now through March 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
Looking for something different musically? Listen to After Hours weeknights at 7 on 89.9 FM, from classical to country.
Give me a word, give me a sign. Show me where to look and tell me what will I find. What will I find? Lay me on the ground, fly me in the sky. Show me where to look and tell me what will I find. What will I find?
Welcome back. Well, as gas prices continue to stay low, the RV business is reaping the benefits. Now, if you've ever thought about checking out a recreational vehicle, now would be the time. John Schuster is president of the Florida RV Trade Association's Northeast Florida chapter. He's here now with more about the Jacksonville RV Mega Show coming up at the Equestrian Center. Hey, John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you on. I didn't even know that there was a show like this in Jacksonville. Tell me all about it. What's going to be happening?
Everybody assembles all the local dealers in one location, and it's a good opportunity for everybody to come out and see what is available on the RV market. And I was listening to you earlier about offshore drilling. And gas prices. And, you know, that's kind of a misnomer that the gas prices really don't affect RV travel as much as you may think.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, even though gas prices are going up, people still want family time. They still want to get out. So they're just not going to drive 600 miles to go on a vacation. They may drive, you know, a couple hundred miles or 100 miles away. So people are still going to get out. They're still going to enjoy the family time.
Sure. And this is a way to do it now. What are some of the new features? When people think of an RV, they probably have somewhat of a stereotypical idea of what all's in one. And what are some of the new bells and whistles that people can come out and look at?
Well, it's interesting that you bring that up, because one of the issues, I think, with our industry is a lot of folks don't realize how affordable it really can be.
Uh-huh.
You know, they'll come on the lot and look at a Class A with either gas or diesel and go, man, that's got to be $600,000. It's like, no, that's like a car payment. That's like $70,000.
Oh.
And so to let folks realize that really, for a family of four, getting a travel trailer and spending $130 a month, you know, for a little over $32 a weekend, you could go out every week. And so as far as bells and whistles go, you know, they can be as quipped as
you want,
as a house in Ponte Vedra, or it can be down and dirty. But even the down and dirty ones, you know, for $9,000-$10,000 for a brand new one, are well equipped with electric and gas and refrigerators and bathrooms and all the comforts of home.
All the comforts of home. Mm-hmm. What would you say to someone listening, a family out there, and they've thought about doing it, but they've just never made the decision?
I would say this is a perfect opportunity to come to the show and see how affordable it is. A quick study a couple of years ago was done for a family of four traveling from Atlanta to the Mouse House down to Disney. If they did regular travel through either airfare or hotels and all that, if they took an RV instead, saved $1,800 that week. Just by using an RV. Because if you think about it, it's your place to sleep, and it's also a place to eat. And so it really is very affordable. You know, for a small car payment, you can be having fun with your family. So this show is a good opportunity for everybody to come out and see what we've got on the market.
You know what else is interesting is your business, I'm seeing online, is ticking upward too, because more retirees are choosing this option. Are you seeing that?
Baby boomers for the next 15 years is going to be a major part of our industry. And so it is growing leaps and bounds, at least 10% every year. It's a very exciting time in the RV industry, and which mirrored the housing market back in, you know, 07, 08. And that's when it was a little bit scary back then. But it has really, really rebounded from manufacturers shipping units to dealers and from people buying and getting into the industry.
Yeah, a new report from AARP that came out last year saying that the greatest generation, the baby boomers, will make about 4 to 5 trips in 2015. And they're the most active group of seniors probably that anybody can ever remember. They're spending $120 billion a year on leisure travel. And more, they're choosing an RV to do it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny because the age group has, it's not funny, it's actually wonderful. The age group has lowered for the person, the folks who are buying an RV. It used to be 60 plus, but now you have 40 plus folks that are buying them, which means more and more families are getting into the business.
Sure. So with all of that said, this is coming up at the Equestrian Center. For people that want to come by, this is going to be going on for a week or so.
This Thursday, actually.
It begins this Thursday, February 26th, at the Equestrian Center on the west side. Runs through Sunday, March 1st. Lots of time to come and check things out.
10 a.m. to 6 p.m. each day. We've got lots of things to give away. All the local RV dealers will be represented there. $8 to get in. But there's also some great incentives. Retired military and first responders, get in for a discounted price, as well as seniors on Thursday. So we'd love to see you there.
Sure. Go on out to the Jacksonville RV Mega Show Thursday through Sunday at the Equestrian Center. Check out what's on hand. Lots of prizes and incentives. John Schuster, president of the Florida RV Trade Association's local chapter. Have fun out there. Thanks for coming by today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And finally, this hour, Stage Aurora is presenting a classic right now, August Wilson's The Piano Lesson. It's the award-winning story that's been done many times, following the Charleses, an African-American family living in Pittsburgh in 1936 as they struggle over the sale of a precious family heirloom. Here in studio, Sidarian Crawford, director, and he plays Boy Willie, and Dericus Holm plays Whining Boy. Guys, good morning. Thanks
good
for
morning.
Being
good
with
morning.
Us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Okay, so this is such a much-loved production, but for people that don't know about The Piano Lesson, let's explain what it's all about.
I think The Piano Lesson is, in a nutshell, really about family. You know, all of us come from a family where there are some things that some of us see as being more precious than others. And I believe The Piano Lesson speaks directly to something that is in a home that this particular family is torn about. They're torn over it. Somebody wants something to happen to it and someone else has another option. And the family is struggling with which option is best for them as a whole.
And fighting over the past, like memories of the past, too. We were kind of talking about that earlier in the show. Would you agree?
I would agree. I think it basically just, like he was saying earlier, it just goes to show that there's differences in families, but it also shows the connection that family has with one another. So it's a really, really good show.
And what's it like to stage this here in Jacksonville?
It's historical. I would say there's a lot of history. There's a lot of historical history here in the city from all different walks of life, from all different nationalities. And to be able to stage something that we believe the community will be able to connect to indefinitely is an opportunity that we do not take for granted.
And August Wilson, such a talent, too. Wasn't this part of a series?
Cycle, yeah,
it was part
cycle.
Of his century mm-hmm. cycle.
Right.
Can you explain what that's all about?
Absolutely. Over the course of 10 years, he wrote a play. He wrote a play for every decade. And The Piano Lesson was the one that won the Pulitzer Prize, one of the ones that won the Pulitzer Prize. It also won a Tony Award. It's recognized as being one of his most astonishing writings. So it's a well-known play. It's a well-known story.
What's it like to now? You're both performing in this show. How do you prepare and get into character?
You just basically get in, you know, try to get in contact with the inner you, the inner person, trying to find out, you know, kind of living the lifestyle that they lived back then, looking at certain things and going back in history, kind of trying to find out, you know, what was going on back in that time and then trying to make that who you are in the play and just kind of connecting with everybody on stage.
Yeah, it's set in 1936, so you've got to have period clothes, set
right.
design.
Right.
What's that challenge like?
Yeah, the challenge is, I had a professor in college who used to say, theater is the mirror that we hold up to society to reveal to themselves who they really are. And if our plan as theatrical performers is to present to society what they look like, we have to make sure that from a historical perspective, the clothes resemble 1930. From a set design perspective, the colors resemble 1930. The speech resembles 1930. The movement resembles 1930. So it's a challenge. But
yeah, I mean, that can be challenging. I mean, people were much more formal back then.
Right.
You know,
right.
how do you rehearse that?
Go ahead.
Well, I was saying it is really challenging, but it's when you put on the clothes and you get into the character and you get on stage and you're there with all the props and everything, it kind of makes you, it just brings it out of you almost in the sense of like you're really there at that moment in the 1930s with everything. So it becomes you at that moment. So it's really, really fun.
Yeah. When you, oh man, every time we add a different portion of the show, when we add costumes, it brings the show to life a little more. When we add the lights, when, you know, we're putting cabinets up right now. And when we put the cabinets up and you see the design of the cabinets and you see the paint on the walls, it just kind of, it's overwhelming sometimes. It really puts you in the mood.
And this is a story, too, about a family whose ancestors were slaves.
Slaves, right.
And so there's a lot going on there too.
Yeah, I, without giving too much away, the point of the piano was that the family's, the grandfather made it a point to carve into memory the things that had happened to him and his family while they were slaves. So the carvings on the piano were permanent. And somebody wants to sell the piano. And somebody else wants to keep that to pass down from generation to generation so that the family will know their own history.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. It's so emotionally powerful.
Yeah, it is.
It is. And then when you have, I'm not too far that my family's a pretty old family. And just to be able to portray something like that, knowing that I'm not that far away from generations of people who have slaves in their family, it kind of brings another element to it for me as well. So it kind of gives you a foundation of the history that your family was a part of.
Sure. And this is a limited run, only a few shows.
Yes.
So let's explain that. It's only on the weekends, beginning this weekend.
This weekend, yes, Saturday. Open Saturday night.
And it runs through March 8th. So if you've never been to a show at Stage Aurora, this is a great opportunity to see the Pulitzer Prize-winning classic, August Wilson's The Piano Lesson, debuting this Saturday, running through March 8th. Get your tickets at stageaurora.org. Cast members Sidarian Crawford, Andricus Holm. Guys, break a leg, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Sure thing, and that's our show.
Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got feedback about the program, we always want to hear it. Just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, high-level officials from the U.S. and Iran may be inching closer to an agreement over limits to Iran's nuclear program. Prospects for the deal and why some argue any agreement could be a security threat to the region and the U.S. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.